you don't ever get it constrained back to where the bureaucracy that you're dealing with can then digest it and get you resourcing and authorities to then go campaign and do other stuff, then it's just a thought exercise.
Greetings, and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational arch and the operational level of war.
I'm Major Josh Bedingfield, here alongside our guest host, Major Jonathan Yanos. Our guest today is Colonel Retired Derek Jones, here representing the Irregular Warfare Center. Colonel Jones is a retired U.S. Army Special Forces Officer, Special Plans Officer for the Irregular Warfare Center, Chief Strategy Officer of Valens Global, a 2009 graduate of the Advanced Military Studies Program at SAMS, and a 2017 graduate of the U.S. Army War College. He is a well-respected subject matter expert in irregular and unconventional warfare with decades of operational experience spanning the globe. Derek holds 4 master's degrees from U.S. Army CGSC, American Military University, SAMS, and the U.S. Army War College.
Sir, welcome. We're glad to have you here.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Josh.
Opportunity. Yeah. So we've got a guest host today. The nature of the work that you do, sir, we thought it best to bring in a small cohort of personnel with experience and professional acumen within the irregular warfare concept. So, John, would you mind quickly kind of introducing yourself to the audience?
Yeah, Major Jonathan Janis, Psychological Operations Officer. Most recent experience with Special Operations Command Europe in the J5. Currently a student in SAMS AMSP and doing research on resistance and UW doctrine.
So the cool tie that we've all got is that I'm doing my research on shadow governments and resistance. You're looking at resistance doctrine. And then, sir, we were talking just before about how you've been writing a lot on resistance.
Absolutely.
So that's my token plug that if we get into a little bit of a resistance rabbit hole, that's why. But the general context for today's episode, you know, the Department of Defense stood up the Irregular Warfare Center less than 6 months ago. The mission of the IWC, and I'm quoting here from the website, is to amplify and collaborate to build an innovative and adaptable, globally networked irregular warfare community of interest, to strategically illuminate current and future irregular threats, crises, and obstacles, and to address current and future irregular threats to the U.S., allies, and partners by providing optionality. We'd like to talk to you today, sir, about the relationship between irregular warfare and the operational level of war, and then past that, how operational art, how it supports irregular warfare. John, you want to get us going?
Yes. So our lead question, sir, would you mind starting our conversation off by talking a little bit about the IWC, the training course that you've developed with TILTC, and where you think what the future of the IWC is?
Yeah, excellent. So I appreciate you taking time out. This is excellent. Dr. Walters wanted to be here. He couldn't, so I'll kind of carry the water. But the Irregular Warfare Center really has a longer history than what we're seeing. We stood up in October. October 1st, been mandated by the NDA that got finalized late in the fall. But the story starts about 15 years earlier when Assistant Secretary Defense for Special Operations Low Intensity Conflict started the Combating Terrorism Fellowship Program, so CTFP. CTFP was a program that was envisioned to help kind of build expertise in terrorism at the time regionally and build out an alumni and a network of folks that had been through kind of the same training and education that they could then expand out across the globe. Dr. Walters, the current acting director, took that program and transitioned over to Defense Security Cooperations Unit or Security Cooperations Agency and continued on from there. So he's been with that program for about 10 years. He transitioned now to the Regional Defense Fellowship Program. And what had happened was over that time, he's been able to produce about 20,000 alumni of this program. And this goes across not just our allies and partners, but also internally interagency. In fact, I just talked to a DHS SCS-3 that was retiring this week, and he had gone through the same program. So he'd been through the CTFP program and still lauded its value. So you know that's kind of an example. So about 3 years ago, Congress began to ask, hey, how do we – it's a successful program. How do we build on this? What can we do to make it more successful? And that's where Dr. Walters and a number of folks were involved in kind of helping them articulate through the legislative process, how do we get to the Irregular Warfare Center, right? So for the last 3 NDAs, it's been in there as a building, the kind of building blocks to get to the center. And then with this one, it sets up the center. So the interesting thing about it is it puts not only an organization, so the Regular Warfare Center, but also the funding. So it combines it with the RDFP funding, and then also adds the authority to talk to all of interagency allies and partners, their government agencies, and then academia and industry. So really a very broad capacity and authority to do that and use that money across that spectrum. So it's under the we call it Section 345 of the legislation, but that's really where we came from. And so we've been in existence about just over 4 months and really been moving out fast to try to fill up the space. Part of that, though, within the first couple of days of getting established, Dr. Walsh just came to us and said, hey, we need to figure out how to kind of educate and broaden the understanding of irregular warfare, especially at the senior level. So if we could just target the senior levels, so he kind of laid out for us, hey, we need some kind of course that will do this. So we had actually had a course that we'd been teaching. This is kind of where the commercial world and the government emerge, that we'd been teaching across a broad spectrum of both government and commercial space on how to do strategic thinking. And so the context of that fits perfectly in regular warfare if you just change the modules. Instead of doing thinking problems and creative thinking around, you know, a business problem or a specific government problem, now we take it around regular warfare. So we do a rapid fire set of case studies where we give a kind of like, you pick your warfare, political warfare, lawfare, information warfare. We give a very quick 10-minute, hey, here's an example of what this is. And then we let the participants then brainstorm and think nefariously, because you have to really think about it from without the constraints to understand what our adversaries are doing and how they're using irregular warfare against us, to then be able to turn around and say, okay, now I can understand how to defend against it, and then also how to use it to impart cost and put my adversaries at risk. So throughout that process, it's a 5-day course. By the time we get down to the fifth day, we've built out a strategy now of how to deal with that real world problem. That's all real world problems that we look at. We don't use any other case studies other than the Kickstarter thought pieces. The rest of them are all tied to this real world problem. What it should do is we then have an integrated campaign. We come out with that. And when we do these interagency efforts, you have the entire interagency in there. We can do them across a broad spectrum of different topics. And then at the end of that, you have the strategy, the campaign, and the ability to now inform higher to policy, with the goal that everybody that leads there now sees the application of common terms. It's not military terms. We're just using common, hey, strategy, campaigning, implementation plans, whatever. But they would be, the following week, they could take all those products and go brief their bosses on, hey, look at this thing we did with this very vast audience or vast participation base from across the interagency, and get us to a better place, understanding-wise, where, you know, you see your supporter bring that to you as a senior leader, like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I would like to be part of that. The next course. So that's kind of how we've started this entire process. That's what the course and the center do together.
Yeah. So one of the things, and we're going to get pretty technical. You know, I've got a professional opinion that might poke a few hedgehogs out there, some naysayers. So regular warfare is something that I have professionally experienced. Somebody, it's not something that I think we've got a broad consensus on what it is.
Yeah.
Definitely within the military construct, and you're talking about bringing in interagency, academia.
Yeah.
I find that to be more true the broader you open your aperture.
Absolutely.
So a general confusion within the big M, and then as you bring other stakeholders in, that confusion kind of broadens because their perspective on its applications, its root constructs also broadens because you have different perspectives on that. So I think it's great that you're bringing those stakeholders in. Unfortunately, we've got a token question. Now we've gotten past what we're talking about, and we're going to ask you to kind of dig pretty deep. You know, you're a 2009 Stamps graduate.
Yeah.
Back when they apparently allowed you to write over 100-page monographs.
It was actually 300 pages. They made me cut it down. So
yeah. Yeah.
I had to go to War College to publish the rest of it.
Yeah. My hat's off to you. They keep us bound to 40 pages, which I think is good. I'm not complaining. Could you briefly describe for the audience your definition or theory of operational art?
Yeah, so I think it's really the creative and skilled approach to linking tactical actions in time and space to achieve a desired strategic outcome. And, I think that's probably close to, you know, what the doctrinal definition is. I think where I venture away from the doctrinal definition is, you know, it's the creative and skilled piece. I think they captured as skilled knowledge, experience, creativity, and judgment, which is, right. The other piece is that they talk about strategic art. or building strategies as part of, you know, what operational art is. I think that's a whole different art. That's strategic art. So I always have taken, I don't think that's quite right. I break those out where I think strategic art is really the linkage, not to strategic outcomes, because that could be tied to your military strategic out, or your military outcomes, but even broader up to the political desired political outcomes on a bigger scale. So, but that's my definition and how I kind of break it out.
Well, I'll give you 5 points. You're the first guest we've had that offered us a definition that was not word for word doctrine.
Oh, there you go.
And then some critical commentary on it. I feel like you might still be able to pass comps.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, then, and then the next one, which is, we're here to talk about irregular warfare. So we've got a good understanding of what your perspective on operational art is. We already talked about, you know, how there might be some non-consensus on what IW is. So it's going to be our longest little prompt for a discussion. It might drive a good bit of the dialogue post it. But there are currently two doctrinal definitions for IW. I'm going to read both of them to pardon with me. But, you know, we've got the joint force defining IW as, quote, a violent struggle among state and non-state actors for legitimacy and influence over the relevant population. And then more recently, the Army's FM3O update, IW is defined, to its credit, as an Army-specific definition, as, quote, the overt, clandestine, and covert employment of military and non-military capabilities across multiple domains by state and non-state actors through methods other than military domination of an adversary, either as the primary approach or in concert with conventional warfare. So I'm going to hold my professional opinion on those two definitions until after you kind of engage this. So that while they're similar, there's some similarities in these two definitions. There are some striking differences between the two. What are your thoughts on it? Where are we at on defining irregular warfare?
Yeah, so this is, you know, this is something we struggle with all the time in the regular warfare center. I'll kind of go broad and come back to this. So, you know, the fundamental issue we have is, you know, what is warfare? You got to get down to that definition, because that's where it all starts. And that's where all of our partners, because the regular warfare center, because we have a broad mandate, you know, we have to think above warfare, right? In fact, most of our partners and allies, as soon as we start talking to them, they're like, hey, we don't want to talk to you because you're all about warfare. You're from DOD. Our point is, no, it's really about irregular threats and irregular challenges and irregular methods to deal with those challenges. So, yeah, that's kind of where we sit, kind of agnostic to the definitions, because they just, definitions plus just warfare in our own name is problematic. We've had more than in the last 120 days, more than a few of our partners say, hey, is there any way for you to change that name?
Your name.
Can you please just get rid of warfare? And I don't actually disagree with them. I think that is problematic if you're trying to be, you know, kind of above the fray. So then we kind of step back and say, okay, let's look at DOD. How is DOD having to define this? And again, ASD SOLIC and Joint Staff J7 are working this right now to redefine it, right? So I don't want to step on any of the stuff they're doing. I think the problematic part in any of these definitions, and I can look at each one and say, okay, hey, you got one's kind of population-centric. And if we think back to the time, you know, we've come through the last 20 years where we were very focused on population-centric counterinsurgency. And so we were kind of in that space. I think the Army took a different approach and they looked at it much broader. They actually define like the entire thing. If you take it out warfare, they define the entire thing, but then they put warfare on it. So now it constrains it back to, I've got a problem because I got warfare in there. Now is what we describe warfare or other things, right? So I think these are all fundamental difficulties, right? So we're tripping over the mouse turd trying to get there. We generally know what we're looking at, but we can't quite define it correctly. And at the end of the day, DOD's got to define what is DOD's role in this irregular, you fill in the blank, that's the problem. So, you know, you hear questions about, hey, it's strategic competition, or no, I'm sorry, competitive statecraft, you know, it's integrated statecraft, which I don't disagree with, although competitive statecraft, all statecraft is competitive, so I, you know, your state's probably gone. Integrated statecraft is a good one, but that's way bigger than any irregular means. That's all, that's the entire toolkit you have available for doing statecraft, right? So, so that doesn't quite fit, it's just too big. So I think we're going to struggle with those. I think, you know, the Asia Pacific Center has done some stuff. You know, another Special Forces, retired Special Forces Colonel Lumpy Labaca, published an article, I think last year, that talked about irregular competition. And he framed it in a way that I thought irregular competition is like, that's a pretty good one. But then I think it misses that, hey, there's also irregular cooperation, right? I'm always out there trying to build resiliency, and there may not be any competition around the country I'm working in now. I may see it in the future, but I'm going to build resiliency today. And that's, I'm going to do it through irregular means. We're going to build their irregular capacity. And then you also have irregular conflict, which is, I think, those things that we call like political warfare, lawfare. They're not really, they're competition is not quite the right word. I mean, there is some kind of conflict going on. We are doing something against each other, but it's not causing anybody to die. But hey, you're messing around in the political system. You know, that's what we, when we refer to political warfare, that's what we're talking about, up until the point, hey, we actually are using violence. But the problem is, when we talk about political warfare short of violence, it is problematic, right? So we don't like people messing around with our election. And if we're saying we're out there doing political warfare, then we're already on the wrong side of that discussion, because we've already changed it and the wording now gets in our way. So you have to be able to kind of understand what are all those little nuances. And if I look at irregular competition, irregular cooperation, irregular conflict short of war, and then have irregular warfare out there, that's a distinct thing when, hey, there's actually violence being employed. Now it actually gives us the ability to use all the tools that you guys have, you know, spent your careers working on, right? All those things short of actually doing it in warfare. I got information support to everything else. I can do civil fair stuff for everything else. But there is a definitive time where I'm going to push over a bound. I'm going to use violence or the absolute threat of violence to get after it. And that's the irregular warfare piece. Until we get to that, we help clean up the definition. We're going to have an issue, but DoD is going to have a hard time articulating across all that entire spectrum to get there.
I think this is an important conversation. In some of the research I've seen in UW and in irregular warfare, you see the downstream effects at these definitions at the joint level as they impact Army doctrine, unconventional warfare. Yeah. What is resistance? Where does it fit in this conversation? So we have to get this definition right. It's going to impact quite a few documents, especially in the Army special operations world. And how do we employ civil affairs? How do we employ psychological operations? How do we converge the soft triad to get effects in irregular warfare? So follow-up question to that, looking at the joint definition, Army definition, and perhaps the new joint definition, maybe focusing on some new research around legitimacy and influencing over populations. Do you think that these new definitions, especially the Army one, reflect that? Is this new theory and research impacting our understanding of irregular warfare going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I guess my counter to that would be, it's not always about the populations, right? So that's what we've kind of come to think about. But is it really about population all the time? And that's there's sometimes where it's about, hey, I'm trying to gain a positional advantage. Doesn't really have to do with your population, but if I'm looking at China, I'm trying to gain strategic positional advantage in all aspects. I want all your information. Instead of wasting my own money, I'm going to steal all of your stuff. So the regular warfare is much broader than, you know, simply working around populations. And I think that's where I've come to realization is, you know, when you get stuck on, hey, it's a population-centric thing, and you don't think about, hey, what are all the other tools in the toolkit? Because at the end of the day, DoD's got to come to grips with, I've got to defend against irregular warfare and or irregular threats, and I also have to employ irregular means to impart costs or put at risk. Right? So is that always around population? I don't know. There's a lot of messaging that goes with that. There's no doubt. There's always about messaging. I'm trying to decrease the will of my enemy in everything I'm doing. That's war, right? We do that everything. Is that, again, is that irregular warfare? Is that just regular war? Is that politics? Is that statescraft? So I think that's why, you know, if you look at the Army definition, then there's nothing about that. It opens up wide and allows you to not get stuck in the population centricity. Now you can think much, much bigger and understand, hey, when I'm watching a fire in Russia, an ammunition plant, yeah, there's a population component of that, right? I'm going after to show you I can reach in. There's also a political piece. I'm targeting you to say, hey, you're not untouchable. I can reach you. And then I'm also going after strategic targets for a purpose, right? So, yeah, it's a complex thing. And you're exactly right. If we don't get the definitions right, then that makes it very hard to then do the entire .PLMF process to get us to where we need to train our tactical forces.
Yeah, there's a great link, I think, to something you said previously about finding a distinction between that cognitive heuristic between like a regular warfare versus what we might say is regular competition, because those downstream effects, if we include that kind of a perspective on distinguishing those two types of activities, you know, they don't just feed soft, I would argue, right? Absolutely. Because, you know, we were talking before the episode about how, you know, the Army's got its phased construct to conflict. Yeah. Right? List goes easy to see when it's an execution. Yeah. And I think that part of the confusion on what irregular warfare is, you know, what is the Oklahoma Army National Guard doing?
Yeah.
When it sends a battalion to Ukraine to train its
territorial defense units.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or when, you know, the FSAB is in Africa, engaging not only MIL partners, but also the partners that that partner force has within the civil component. Yeah. Right? I'm not fighting. Right? So I'm not in conventional or traditional warfare. But I'm not really in a regular warfare
exactly,
because there's no conflict. But there's certainly a component of a regular competition, because the effects of those types of missions, all of big armies' activities from phase zero up to LISCO, and arguably after the cessation of combat operations, right? We're focusing on generating effects that are not military-centric. Right. There's governance, there's legitimacy, there's resilience, there's resistance, there's all these intangible things.
Yeah, in fact, some of that stuff I could be doing, like the, I'm building resiliency in a country, so that's a regular cooperation, right? Versus competition, it's regular cooperation because nothing's going on, right? So if I'm getting there and I can build a resilience and it never becomes a competition zone, then haven't I done what I should have done in the first place?
Sounds right? A hell of a lot like deterrence.
Yeah, I think it's called deterrence, right? Yeah. So it's just like, you know, in my, you know, kind of the, my background of building resilience capacity has always been, hey, that's a massive irregular deterrent if you get it right. Because now I don't know exactly what you have, especially if I keep it clandestine and hidden. I don't know what you have. It's hard for me to account the, you know, for it. I have to think about the combat ratios. What does the occupation look like if I can't see it? You know, I think about Iraq. We went into Iraq. It seemed easy. And so we didn't really account for, hey, you've got a population that has what I term kind of the, you know, high potential for clandestine operations, right? So it had a high clandestine potential. They had folks that knew how to do clandestine stuff all the way down to the family level because they'd all been penetrated down to the family level. That's how Saddam Hussein kept his, you know, grips on everything. So we roll in there, and now the resistance rises up. Well, the resistance already knew how to run clandestine stuff because they'd been doing it in their families, right? Their families didn't even know they were doing it. So every family pretty much had somebody who was, you know, kind of trained in these arts, and that makes it much tougher. But that's back to you. If I would have known that before I went in there, like now I like, hey, before we look at something, we should figure out, hey, how hard is that going to be? And what's the clandestine potential in this environment? If it's very low, you got a much better chance of being able to occupy and control. We would never say we occupy, but that's what they perceive it as. But if they don't have that, then that's okay. That's one less thing I need to worry about. It's going to take them a long time to organize. I just have to keep them from organizing. And I think that's, again, back to additional things we've never really thought about from counterinsurgency's perspective.
But I think that gets back to even the importance of, like, what is a regular warfare? And then if we can define it correctly, and if we can then assess the environment susceptibility to some of these activities, and then we can show our conventional force commanders what capabilities we can provide them in conflict through these resilience operations, throughout capabilities in RSOF or even the National Guard. At SOC here, we had trying to deal with some of these issues is how do we integrate these within the TSOC, but also then how do we integrate it within the combatant commander's campaign plan to show that these things that we're doing in campaigning, building resilience, actually have effects should the war plan be activated. If we can walk the dog, so to speak, with our conventional force commanders through doctrinal consensus and understanding so that we can, hey, show effects here in campaigning, but that we actually can have a battlefield effect on the adversary and allow our conventional force commanders to seize their operational objectives more efficiently.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, you're talking about the National Guard going and training a territorial defense force. Well, those territorial defense forces are going to roll over and be the guerrilla force in these efforts. So they're actually doing, you know, same stuff special operations has done for years, but they're doing it because they have that common bond, right? And so this is why it's bigger than SOF. SOF does not equal irregular warfare. It's bigger than that. Every component has some play in this space. And again, why when we get stuck down in warfare, it just the warfare part gets hard. Yeah, we might be preparing for future warfare, but today, what am I doing? So yeah, I think that's our
point. I think we're all, you know, at least from the SOF personnel at SANS right now, I think we're all really comfortable buying in and being strong advocates for the first fit for, you know, First Special Forces Command's tagline, you know, the premier regular warfare force.
Yeah.
And that's because we've got some boutique capabilities, some boutique training, some novel perspectives on operational environments. But that doesn't mean that the rest of the force doesn't participate and contribute critical and equally boutique capabilities,
yeah,
right? Due to for no other reason than scale, right? Scale, scope, and there are no pilots in CA or SF or SIOP, right? So I can't train your aviation force or
And we can't lose the recent experience that the conventional forces have over the last 20 years in various regular conflicts.
Yeah, but it does bridge us, I think, well to a conversation on, you know, the operational level of war. It's another stream where this concept of regular warfare nests within more conventional concepts, you know. So the operational level of war, which I personally think is a real thing, come at me, is, you know, it's where campaigns are waged, right? A battle is a battle. That's tactical. Campaigns are the linking through time and space of those tactical actions toward achieving some operational, potentially even a strategic outcome. Does this remain true in a regular warfare where the tactical action isn't a battle, right? What does the operational level look like within a regular warfare?
Yeah, so it's a great question and a great point. So if you look at, you know, we get tactics in our military mindset. If I now translate that out and think about the broader aspects of irregular means, regular activities, and what those look like, all those fishing boats and the paramilitary fishing boats that the Chinese are putting out there, building an island somewhere, you know, those all become pieces and parts of actions that are playing in part of their campaign, right? So they're campaigning all the time in these spaces, doing things that we just don't really pay attention to or understand. Hey, that's actually just an irregular activity that they're using for their benefit. So when you're using a maritime militia that I can't quite figure out what it's doing, I can't target it, I can't really do anything with it. Well, the ambiguity in that now makes it very hard for anybody to do anything with it, and it's kind of successful. Well, that's all campaigning, right? So the change is the fact that, hey, it's a broader understanding of not just a tactical military tactics or a military unit doing something. Now it's the entire spectrum of what could be going on for the, you know, for Chinese as adversaries. You know, they're putting professors in the United States to do things here. I mean, that could be that one little activity that they're doing. And so I think it just forces us to broaden the perspective. And this is where the integrated campaigning and the ideas of, hey, we've got to integrate better. I was at a conference recently in Washington. It was a gray zone conference. But the same topic was still coming up. Hey, we've got to figure out how to integrate better across our U.S. government to be successful. And if you think about the way the Chinese and authoritarian governments can do this, they can have integrated, right? They're all, everything the Chinese are doing is to advance their position somehow. And that's it. Again, some of that's regular stuff. Some of that's just political stuff. But there's a huge irregular component to that that's happening. And it's not military stuff. It's largely other things. So for me, that's all part of campaigning. That's changing our mindset and understanding that, hey, you can try to do regular stuff on your own as DoD, which, you know, your toolkit's very small. So it's like a scalpel. And you can't bring a big sledgehammer in like you can when you're talking major combat operations. So now that little scalpel, you need to add it to a bunch of scalpels to have death by a thousand cuts, or it's just doing nothing.
Right. So within that, I think great example, right? The cognitive, you know, walking the dog on it would be a fishing vessel in the South China Sea. Yeah. That was disrupting fishing lanes or economic, you know, exclusion zones and all that stuff. That's kind of an irregular action.
Correct.
But a network of them that is integrated with other activities and synchronized in time and space.
Yeah.
Now we're looking at an irregular campaign.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can buy that. I'll buy it for a dollar.
Yeah.
So following up on that, so TILT-C is focused on the senior leaders throughout the interagency. How do you plan to engage these senior leaders and cognitively develop them to frame irregular warfare activities or operations and investments within a conventional or regular military operation, or perhaps even a joint or interagency activity like a disruption of an adversary's fishing fleet?
Yeah, so I think the first thing we do is we don't talk about the military, right? So when we are going through TILT-C, there is no military terms. It is all, and we couch it in, hey, we use kind of civilian design methodology. I mean, we can, there's a whole other debate on how we've done with design inside the military. My sense is the commercial world and you know, some of our interagency partners actually are probably more creative thinkers and actually could do design better. That's what I've seen. And so now it's a conversation of, hey, let me not get you tied into doctrinal, you know, this is what strategy is. Here's how we do this stuff. It's to, how do I, all I need to do is facilitate the discussion. And structure in a way that when we get done, we actually have some kind of action. I think that's, you know, one of the fundamental problems with design is you can think big, but if you don't, my touch point is if you don't ever get it constrained back to where the bureaucracy that you're dealing with can then digest it and get you resourcing and authorities to then go campaign and do other stuff, then it's just a thought exercise. You're actually not advancing the ball anywhere. So without that little piece of, hey, it's got to be actionable, applicable to the partners, then you don't get anywhere. So what we've seen is as we do it, we use all real world problems. They bring in their own issues, right? And they're dealing with their own issues, but now they're saying, oh, hey, my issue is actually, hey, it's connected to your issue. So if you did that first and I did this thing and then, you know, somebody else does this thing, all of a sudden we actually have a much better outcome. A lot of times, you know, we strategize and, you know, kind of operate in the U.S. government in like true cylinders, right? There's just cylinders of excellence where everybody, you know, can have a national defense strategy and you're trying to do all you can in your department or agency to advance the ball. But without having that integrated left and right, you're just advancing the ball on your own, right? So it's a whole bunch of folks out there operating, but not with a central focus. So, you know, this gives us a chance to see that in time and space and educate and have people walk away from the events and, huh, that was weird. That was different. I saw how we could come together. It wasn't a military thing. It was just a thing. Like we just sat around and talked about how do we do this better. And that should inform policy. That should inform actions. And so that's where we're trying to go to get to that point where if I get enough folks that have been through this, at what point do we tip over and now we can actually have a conversation, fix the issues we've been talking about for years for interagency cooperation because we have a common language and we have folks that have seen it. They get to watch it in action and they know it's not as hard as it sounds like it's going to be.
Yeah, and I spent some time with the Russia Information Group kind of exploring some of what the interagency and sub-agencies were doing to combat Russian disinformation. And I thought one of the advantages of our system is we have so much freedom of action at some of the mid-grade levels. And I spent about 6 months just finding new people that were working on the problem.
Absolutely.
The trouble is integration, right? And how do we combine those in time and space to actually have an effect on the adversary? It seems like that's part of the initial or the future goal of this organization is to build that network, create those touch points so that we can reach out to folks throughout our partners and in your agency to actually have those effects looking in towards
it. And you guys watched as you've gone through your career, you kind of needed to see what was out there to understand how you fit into the bigger picture, right?
Absolutely.
So every time you move up to a new rank in the military, oh, now I see how that fits together. So a lot of times in your agency, they just don't understand what that looks like. So putting them all in a room, and you know, we're not going to hit senior leaders initially. We're kind of coming in at the GS 14-15, you know, SES level 1. If we can start there and get enough buy-in there, then it'll move up and down. That's what we're going for, that sweet spot to kind of pull it up and then ideally push opportunities down to the integrated campaigning side.
You know, we're in an interesting situation in the conversation where we've you know, have a direction. We have planned to go. We've already kind of talked about what's novel about irregular warfare, talking about integration and cross-domain integration of interagency capabilities and capacity. We talked about how executing one supports the other, traditional and irregular warfare. But I'm curious, you know, there's some recent literature has come out, I'd say, over the last decade. We'll define that as recent for the purpose of my posit, on how, you know, nations are becoming increasingly wary of conducting large-scale combat operations. It seems odd, given the fact that we're in the midst of one right now, but you know, one could make an argument there's some validity to this concept that large-scale ground combat over the modern global system that we've built is just something that we're increasingly apprehensive. And by we, I mean the global system. Mm-hmm. Does that, from your perspective, is that encouraging us to, or nations, to become more proficient or to rely more on irregular means to achieve their policy?
Yeah.
I ask that to say, you know, in a short form, where does IW fit in the future of conflict? Is it the new normal?
Yeah.
How do we approach it? How do we approach the future of it?
Yeah, so I think let's take a step back and look at the last time we went through a major conventional fight in World War II, and then what came out of that, right? So we transitioned to the Cold War, and we actually watched where covert action, which is the same thing, right? Covert action became kind of the principle, and we wanted to maintain, you know, low intensity conflict wars, and we generated those and sometimes participated in them, and that became kind of the norm, right? And that was to keep us from stepping over into a nuclear confrontation. I think now what you're saying is, okay, you're right. There's a lot of apprehension about just combat, right? Like the stuff going on in Ukraine, if that grew out into a larger conflict, what would that look like? What would that entail? And we're watching the use of munitions. I mean, when you really start thinking about how many munitions we've used in just a little tiny piece of the world, could we even sustain that? And then step back to the next level is, okay, if we don't go to the nuclear level, but we just go down to just hypersonics, how does hypersonics now change the game? Hey, would I even be able to get forces to somewhere to actually get into that major combat? And if I can't get their forces there to have a major combat operation, now what, right? So then we step back and like, okay, regular warfare becomes one of those things. I think what you're watching now in Ukraine is the power of irregular warfare. You're seeing it combined with kind of the more conventional piece, but then you got this irregular undertone to everything, right? So you got kind of the resistance going on. You got what I'd call strategic sabotage happening. So that's happening in, you know, pretty far out. You got an information environment that's just fascinating. I mean, Ukrainians have just done an amazing job. And with all their partners, right? So it's really the entire globe has, you know, kind of crowdsourced to help Ukraine. And watching that has been itself another thing, right? You're watching the citizens deciding, hey, I'm going to go participate in combat operations when my government doesn't. So I think what you're going to see is, I think that trend will continue. I think we'll see that, hey, war is expensive when you get down to this level and you're actually in fully engaged in conventional fight. That's an expensive way to go and really painful. So if you're trying to save money, I mean, you actually want to have potentially even a greater impact than irregular warfare and irregular means, becomes a very viable way to do it. And the past where it was about asymmetries, our adversaries were using irregular warfare against us because the asymmetric piece of it, we were just too strong. And that was the way they could do it without, you know, us being able to kind of use our capabilities to our advantage. Now everybody's using it. So I think that's you're watching just irregular warfare grow in its use. And I think that's going to be that long-term trend.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to do a shameless plug right here, but it's almost like you're saying that, you know, a significant investment of special operations led and conventional force led irregular warfare injects into a partner force can yield significant returns.
Absolutely.
In terms of both their capability to wage irregular resistance. Yep. And conventional defense.
Yep.
It's madness.
It's true. But I would say, always back to the big tent, but that's just one part of it, right?
Right.
So we need the rest of our partners, interagency allies, and actual foreign partners to build their own capabilities so that we can impart greater cost and put greater risk, right? So it's really about the risk calculation, right? So the more capabilities we have on a broader scale, not just military, but across the entire interagency partners and allies, then we have a toolkit that, do you really want to mess with that? Mm-hmm. And that's the key. So there is an investment, but that also goes back to, it's got to be integrated to get the greatest impact.
Yeah, there's a red team take. If Ukrainian capability capacity, in contrast between 2014 and 2022, is the delta between those two capabilities capacity, is the byproduct of the investment of irregular injects into their systems
from multiple countries
from a value of X, right, equals the capability and capacity we're seeing in 2022. Like, the red team take on it is, what if we'd been doing it better?
Oh yeah.
And like, what if we'd had that interagency cooperation or that interagency integration at a greater degree over that 8-year period of time? Where would the conflict be? Had we been able to increase that delta a little bit more?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the other thing, to step back and say, okay, we're watching Ukraine. We watched the outcomes of Afghanistan and Iraq. And now, if you're a smart leader thinking about statecraft, would you want to venture into an invasion unless you're 100% sure you're going to win? And so I think we watched, hey, I think I'm 100% sure I'm going to win. That didn't work out the way I thought it was going to work. And so now we're back to, can we reestablish deterrence? Especially for the irregular deterrent side, have built the population's capacity for being resilient, but also underneath it, prepared. If you're not deterred by that, I've got this resistance capacity available that I can now add to that deterrence factor and as a response if you try to invade.
Looking forward to that, sir. Do you have any other lessons that we should be drawing from Ukraine? And we understand the conflict is still in its early stages, and there's potential for offensives in the spring. You know, seems to be all of our strategic leaders are not necessarily preparing for a decisive end to the conflict anytime soon. Where do you see, so I guess question one, what lessons is the IWC drawing? And then how do we integrate those lessons into the interagency and the joint force moving forward?
Yes, I think there's really from the Irregular Warfare Center perspective, we're looking at kind of three aspects. There's a lot of aspects. We're always looking across the entire spectrum of, you know, regular conflict and how they're going to play. But I think from Ukraine specifically, you know, we're looking at obviously the effectiveness of resistance and the efforts over there. So that's one piece, and kind of the way we're defining it out is what the success of resistance to invasion, you know, which is the mobilization of the population once the invasion starts, compared to resistance to occupation, which if you don't prepare for that, you're now learning once you're occupied, which has been kind of the historic model. And what we at Soft Hero are always trying to do is, hey, how do we prepare that to resist the occupation, right? So I think we did, you know, the resistance to invasion is doing well, the resistance to occupation is not doing so well, right? So, and I think we're seeing that, hey, you can't transition cleanly from resistance to invasion as an overt force, or as an overt guerrilla force, into then occupied space and operate then clandestinely. It just doesn't, that transition doesn't happen well. That's kind of what we've been, we have a few things that our subject matter experts have written over the last couple of years, or last year, on this topic specifically. So I think that's one. I also think the other side of this is, okay, so how do the Russians occupy? So there's not a lot of definitive studies on that. So that's something that we're actually, we have the Russian way of occupation study that we're working through. So we're hoping to have that, at least some initial pieces out of that. We've discovered some really fascinating stuff. We're doing translations now, some really interesting things we've discovered. In the next couple of weeks, I think we'll see a manual that the Russians have put out on how to resist in the Ukrainian occupied areas, right? And it's a fascinating manual. So we're going through all the legal checks with the right disclaimers to get it published. But I think those are the kind of things that, you know, our native Russian speakers are translating. They're just finding this stuff as part of the study. So we got some of this stuff we'll kind of kick out of there. So that Russian way of occupation, it's going to be a long-term study. I think that'll kick off a lot of other studies, but it's going to look at today, how they occupy today, their doctrinal pieces and parts that we can find and get translated. And then historically how they done occupation all the way back through the Cold War to World War II, where we start seeing kind of how they do it. Now, the filtration camps is nothing new. I mean, they were using filtration camps World War II, probably way before that. But we're looking right kind of from World War II on. That's coming out. That'll be out there. And then the third aspect is really that strategic sabotage. Okay, what does that mean? And how does that play into the you know, into conflict, right? If you can extend your range and get into what, for the Russians, pretty secure space, and all of a sudden they're taking shots, who's doing it? Is it, you know, their population? Is it actually infiltrators? You know, how is that going, and what impact is it having overall? To us, that's kind of a fascinating just sidebar. Now, those for me are personally very interesting. So that's where I've been looking, but we're also looking at information operations, the different aspects. We have a book we're about to publish here in the next couple months. It's not looking specifically at Ukraine, but it's looking at trends, kind of longer term regular warfare trends. So yeah, all that stuff's coming out. We're working on different aspects.
That's pretty interesting, I think, and especially some of those things we're working at Soccer, which is really building on the work that you did, sir, is, you know, you just, these forces that just roll over after perhaps conventional resistance has faded or the battlefield has moved on. Yes, they can be part of resistance to occupation, but I believe some of the scholars that you have on your team, Dr. Stringer, Dr. Fabian, are, how do we build those resistance forces in concert with conventional resistance? Yeah. And the need for the professionalization of those forces and those task organizations to resist occupation, not necessarily to resist the conventional invasion from the adversary. I know you just spoke to that, but is that something that, yes, we see a lot of talk in the academic world or kind of from practitioners that have moved to the academic space, but how seriously are our military leaders or thinkers taking that prospect?
Well, I think, you know, slowly, I think everybody's starting to recognize it, right? So when we started these programs, you know, almost a decade and a half ago or a decade ago, you know, when we go brief this, people are like, yeah, I'm not really sure about this. Or it'd be this flip side. They're like, why aren't we doing this? We're not doing this. I thought we were doing this. So it's always been kind of tough. There's nothing better than having a conflict that, you know, you learn like, oh, wow, we should have that resistance stuff. So I think now, better than any other time that we've had from that resilience and resistance perspective, now people generally understand that. They've seen it. They want to touch it. The hard part is, what does that look like and how do we get it prepared? We're military, so we always think about that. Hey, I need to build the military aspects of this thing. So we're very good at the territorial defense forces, the special operations. But we then forget, hey, if any of these conflicts go, the key thing is, hey, how do I maintain continuity of governance? transition to governance exile, shadow governance, that's now bounded legally in legislation so that the population, back to legitimacy, knows, hey, that's going to happen. Hey, part of my government's going to run away on purpose so they can continue the fight externally. Then they'll be the legitimate outside pulling in support for the shadow government running the resistance day-to-day inside. If you don't have that before conflict built, you're probably going to have a hard time building it, right? And so these are the things that, you know, when we started these programs that we were aiming for. We've creeped heavy over to the military side. I think the resistance to invasion, we've shown we could do that. We kind of missed the resistance to occupation. And so that's struggled. And at the end of the day, you know, we built the Special Operations Executive and the, we didn't, but the Brits did, and the Office of Special Services to go organize resistance in occupied areas, right? After they're occupied. Right. And we did the same thing with Green Berets. We kind of walked away from World War II doing the same thing. My point in 2010 is, why wouldn't I just organize it now? Before they occupy,
right?
And especially given that we may not have the political will to actually put SF folks on the ground to be with the resistance. So if I can build it good now and I can test them and I can get everything set up for them to run, if I'm not there, it that may not matter as much. Or I only have to put one or two operators, not an entire ODA in the ground to organize. I just put one or two in there to do a liaison. And now my footprint's smaller, my signature's smaller. There's a lot of other issues go along with that. Just the signature by itself. I mean, it's not like they're going to be, if they broadcast a report out of an occupied area, somebody knows they're there, but then the hunt starts again. So there's a bunch of nuances that, you know, our folks, and that's where we got PhDs, but we also got folks that do the application side like myself. So we have the National Resistance Application Course that is looking at this entire, from the strategic level down, to help plug in and kind of fill those gaps from where we've been teaching theory for all these years and doing a lot of great tactical work. How do we now break it back out and help at the strategic level for countries? And what does that look like? So that's what we're focused on.
I'm always just very excited whenever we encounter, you know, either in class or in conversations like this, you know, an observation of a lesson being learned that we can find a really great historical anecdote to say, oh, hey, like that happened before. We had an opportunity to learn that. You know, so I'm like looking a lot into solidarity for my research. And there's so much on how you had this 10 million strong resistance to the Communist Party in Poland. And then martial law gets put in and it dissipated overnight. And all of its authors were talking about and lamenting over the fact that why weren't we able to go underground? Yeah. Why were we able to operate overtly within this environment? And then when a challenge arose, we couldn't just transition into a clandestine type organization. So I would argue, you know, we've had at least one opportunity historically to learn that lesson. I'm glad we're talking about it now. Yeah. But
and the key there was just that one is that was before big data.
Sure.
Transitioning now, if you haven't thought about the big data signature and signature reduction and management, game's over.
Sure. Which is to say that it would have been easier for them.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Right? They had an easier time. That's why you have to prepare ahead of time and think about that. So
Well, sir, you know, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great talk. I know you've got some future engagements today. Do you have any closing words for the audience? I want to point them in a direction to find any of your current or upcoming work?
Yeah. So, thanks for the opportunity. Anytime I get to talk about the Irregular Warfare Center, it's a good day. We've got a great crew of just folks that are passionate about this topic. And that goes from Dr. Dennis Walsh, who's acting director, and the stuff he's done as a quite, you know, the former, another great story, a former Green Beret that built this program, and look what it's produced today. Look what it will produce in the future. So as kind of that founding father of this entire effort, I think it's a good soft story that hasn't gotten out there. It's a good irregular warfare story as well, of what we can do. And hopefully it's setting the stage for what we can do in the future. And, you know, in that concert with the ASD SOLIC and the Defense Security Cooperation Agency and universities, you know, we see a lot of potential. And we're seeing, you know, every time we can engage, the more we engage, the more people learn about the Irregular Warfare Center, the better. We're growing the network every single day. So I would recommend if you can come visit us at our website at www.irregularwarfarecenter.org and reach out to us on the information email and tell us if we can help you or if you've got some ideas.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Ter.
Thank you.
This has been an official publication of the School of Advanced Military Studies. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS and the Operational Arch by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS. don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode, send any proposals to operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.